Well, hi there. The death of movies and independent movies a few years ago was greatly exaggerated. And that's a relief to all of us who love the cinema. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you're like me and you love to go to the movies, you might remember a few years back, there was all this talk about the internet being the end of going to the movies. Remember that? We were all going to stay home. We were going to sit on the couch, crank up Netflix, and we would never leave. Lucky for all of us, that hasn't happened. Many of the theaters have retooled. Comfy seats, great audio, a really nice experience. Now, as we head into the first weekend of the new year, we are looking into what cultural events are underway in our region. The Cinema Arts Center on Long Island has a packed calendar. We're going to talk about two of them today. First, this Sunday, the center is going to feature a documentary and discussion on Anne Frank. With her diary, Frank brought readers into her world, a teenager who was living in hiding from the Nazis in Amsterdam during World War II. Author Gillian Wands-Perry commissioned the Academy Award-winning film Anne Frank Remembered. The curator of the center, Judd Newborn, organized the event. They're both with us today. Hi, Gillian. Hi, Judd.
Hello, Ron.
Hey there.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yes.
Happy New Year to both. Judd, I'm going to get to Gillian and the story of Anne Frank in 1 second. But for those who may be unfamiliar with the Cinema Arts Center, tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, my. Well, the Cinema Arts Center is 45 years old now and began, it's one of the first and foremost in the nation. It began at the same time as Film Forum in New York City. In fact, we worked together to found what have become art cinemas. And in those days, it was, you know, every now and then a foreign film was shown in certain places. And the art cinema movement grew and supported independent filmmaking and also has, you know, been able to show major studio films and important documentaries. So at this point, we're the gem of Long Island. We have more than we have 11,000 members. That's more than any other cultural arts institution on Long Island. We are not for profit, just in case anyone thinks we're a movie theater. Also, we're not a movie theater. We're a community. We have three large theaters, a fourth Sky Room Cafe, which is also has a fourth screen, and we hold multi-arts events there, like music, dance, jazz, folk music. And people come into the cafe to talk about, not only to eat organic food. We are green and organic and vegetarian when we can be, but not always.
With organic popcorn too, right?
Yes, we have the best organic, no Franken popcorn on at the Cinema Arts Center. So people come and they not only enjoy the food, but they can talk about the films before and after, analyze them. And just enjoy themselves. So it's a community with a lot of space and a beautiful sculpture garden. You can't get this in a place like New York City. There's not enough space, and you can't get this sense of community either. So it's a very special place. My special thing is to bring in nationally and internationally known luminaries of all backgrounds, not just film. I've had Nobel laureates, Kennedy Center honorees, an Academy Award, Tony, Emmy, Grammy, Pulitzer Prize winners and nominees. This is, of course, a great thing because you get the kind of entertainment that you might have to pay so much more for in New York City without having to worry about parking garages and expensive dinners, though we have great restaurants. It's better, it's easier, and it's more comfortable. So I interviewed them before live audiences. And then we have everything else. We have series on silent movie with accompanying music by the Museum of Modern Art's main organist. He comes to us. We have lots of documentaries that you might not otherwise see that are really consciousness-raising on the things that really matter to us today. We have made, we are sought after by major studios to showcase and run their films, fine films, great films, but the same films you'll see in multiplexes, except we won't have some of the, pardon the expression, you know, what can I say? Garbagey stuff. But we will have a cult cafe at night with films that attract young people. We're really an important institution on Long Island, as well as a home for people who really want to think and experience the world beyond their own four walls.
That sounds great. I can't wait to visit. Judd, we're going to talk in a few minutes a little bit more about the arts and cinema and everything going on with it. Jillian, thank you for being patient. First of all, your book is amazing, The Legacy of Anne Frank. Congratulations.
Actually, thank you. It wasn't a question of being patient, because I was just fascinated listening to Judd describing the Arts Center. I actually can't wait to be there on Sunday morning.
It sounds magnificent. I have friends who have gone there, and they've told me about it. I haven't had a chance to visit, but the next time I'm on the island, I will be going. It sounds amazing.
Yes, and that Jillian's event is right at the heart of the kind of thing we also do, things that really matter. But you go ahead, Jillian.
So, Jillian, your book is The Legacy of Anne Frank, and obviously you have been writing about, studying, talking about Anne Frank for decades now. Why is it that this girl who died so horribly at the hands of the Nazis, why is it that so many years later her story resonates with us?
Well, let me tell you that I've got quite a unique perspective on the story, because I haven't just been studying and writing it. I actually was the co-founder with friends and family of Otto Frank, Anne Frank's father, of the Anne Frank Trust in the UK, which is the educational charity, which is a partner organization of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam and of the wonderful Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect, which is based in New York, who are very, very good friends of mine. And I'm there sort of helping and advising them at the moment. And they do incredible programs. So I've been really in the heart of Anne Frank work and education and really her story and her life for 3 decades now. So and having the privilege also, Ron, of meeting many of the people that knew Anne Frank personally and knew Otto Frank personally. And he's our great inspiration because of his educational vision that he wanted to use the diary as an incredible force for good, so that children wouldn't have to suffer like his own 2 beautiful daughters had had so terribly. But basically, why is she still so popular? Why is she still so relevant? Because she is she comes over as a real person. She wasn't a saint, Ron. She was an ordinary, feisty teenager going through those same things that every child goes through in transitioning from childhood, where you've got your parents around you to do everything for you and look after you, into becoming an adolescent and taking on the responsibility of becoming an adult and you having to make your own way in the world. But this girl was trapped in extraordinary circumstances because of her birthright, who she was. She happened to be born Jewish in Germany, just as the Nazis were coming into power. And, of course, her family had to flee as refugees to Amsterdam. They thought that would be their salvation. Tragically, it wasn't. And we talk about Anne. We talk about the structure of her family, how she didn't get on with her parents. She objected to everything the adults were doing. And we see her change from a gossipy child to a young woman that is taking on responsibility for the world, and the poignancy of it, Ron, that this was a girl that wanted to go and make the world better, and she wasn't allowed to do that, and she died in terrible circumstances. So every generation seems to relate to that, seems to understand it. It's almost like their own life being acted out, and whether it's boys, whether it's girls, whether they're from whatever a cultural, religious background, they identify with Anne Frank. So, you know, I've worked at the heart of this for 30 years, going into schools, going into prisons with the Anne Frank story, going into communities. And that's what inspired me, that I had to sort of capture this in the book, the work that's being done not only in America, not only in the UK, but around the world in Anne Frank's memory. And her legacy is, as you've read in the book, is truly surprising. I mean, some of the most turbulent and violent regions of the world, Anne Frank has had a role in bringing people back together. That's a long answer to your short question.
No, it's okay. But I just need a short answer for this one, too, because I remember because we have to take a break soon, but I remember as a kid, I mean, we're going back 40 years now, going to Amsterdam and going to her house and being struck by it. And 40 years later, I can still remember that feeling.
Yes, exactly. And I still meet with here from people who first went to see an Anne Frank exhibit. That what we work with 30 years ago and say, oh, well, it was only about 10 years ago. Memory was so vivid. And if you went 40 years ago to the Anne Frank House, it's time for you to go back, by the way, because it's changed quite dramatically. And it really speaks to a new generation. I just want to tell you to touch on how I know Judd.
And you know what? I'm going to give you a chance to do that in just one moment because we do have to take a short break. But the good part is when we come back from the break, we'll have another 18 minutes to talk. So we'll be able to talk about many other aspects of this. That is Jillian Wands-Perry, the author of The Legacy of Anne Frank, and Judd Newborn, the curator of the Cinema Arts Center on Long Island in Huntington. They are going to be with us, as I said, for another 20 minutes or so. I'm Ron Ropiak. This is The Full Story. We'll be right back. We continue talking about something that is taking place this Sunday at the Cinema Arts Center, and there is a documentary and discussion about Anne Frank. Jillian Wands-Perry commissioned the Academy Award-winning film Anne Frank Remembered, and the curator of the center, Judd Newborn, is also with us. Jillian, I apologize. I had to cut you off to take a break, and you wanted to pick up on something that Judd said?
No, I wanted to just tell your listeners how Judd and I, our paths crossed and why I'm at the Cinema Arts Center, because each year the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect has a Spirit of Anne Frank Awards gala. And I was fortunate in June last year to be invited to be the MC of the gala. And I presented Judd with the Anne Frank Center's Human Rights Award, rights being spelled W-R-I-T-E-S, because he's written the most wonderful book, which I hope you've reviewed on your program, on Sophie Scholl and the White Rose Group in Germany. And if you haven't reviewed that book and had it on your show, it is absolutely riveting and marvelous because you clearly love books. So that's really one to read, Ron. And you know, we got into conversation when we talked about my book, and when I knew I was coming back to New York, I contacted Judd. And he told me all about this remarkable center. And I'm so excited for Sunday to be able to see Anne Frank Remembered, the movie, again, because, as you mentioned, I did initiate it and commission it with John Blair, this incredible director. And he went on and won an Oscar and an Emmy for this movie. This the first British documentary in 20 years to win an Oscar. And I was really privileged to be at the Academy Awards ceremony in Hollywood for the Oscar ceremony. But not only that, I was there with Meep Heath. And Meep Heath was the courageous helper of the Frank family in hiding. And obviously she features a lot in my book, but features in the film. And to walk down the red carpet in Hollywood with this amazing woman, and then to see her go up on stage with John when he won the Academy Award in front of a billion TV viewers who must have been thinking, who on earth is this little white-haired old lady up on the stage with all the glamorous movie stars? And I will be on Sunday in the discussion describing the thrill of being at the Academy Awards and seeing John Blair deservedly win that Oscar and him going up on stage with Meep. It was something absolutely unforgettable.
Unfortunately, hate crimes are still with us. We see what happened in Pittsburgh. We hear all the time about other aspects of anti-Semitism that takes place in the United States and around the world. Your film came out, I believe it was 1995?
That's right.
Is it more relevant than ever now?
Yeah, absolutely, as is the work. Any work, you know, using Anne Frank is absolutely more, sadly, more and more relevant. And you know, what we want to do, Ron, is get into the hearts and minds of young people when they are young, when they are impressionable, when they can understand through reading Anne's diary, through seeing these amazing photographs of her that are in the exhibits that her father, who was a very keen photographer, took of his two daughters, and seeing who these people really were. And so we've got this incredible resource of her, what she looked like, and of her mind. And she describes so articulately in that diary what it really feels like to be the victim of irrational hatred. And what we say to young people is, my goodness, wouldn't it be a boring world if we were all modeled as clones, the same people, very much like Hitler and the Nazi Party wanted? Isn't it wonderful that we have such diversity in our society, that we have people from all races, all skin colors, all accents, all heritages, and we can all live together and be part of a vibrant community? And that's how we try to get young people through Anne Frank's story to understand the irrationality of hating people.
Judd, I haven't forgotten about you. How are sales going for this event on Sunday?
We don't normally get that many advance sales for a Sunday. We call this a Sunday schmooze. At 10 a.m., people have a bagel brunch, and then from 11 until 1, we'll see this Academy Award-nominated film, which really is and was groundbreaking. And Jillian, having commissioned it, is really it's really an important thing that she did that. We have, I don't know, we're almost half sold out from advance tickets, and most people just show up at the door. So I think we're going to be totally sold out, and all of her books are going to fly, by the way. The Legacy of Anne Frank, her book, is so moving. I mean, it covers the legacy of Anne Frank in as many ways as you could think, but it also contains moving passages about famous people, worldwide icons like Nelson Mandela, and how Audrey Hepburn, who grew up in the same circumstances as Anne Frank, but as a non-Jew in Holland, experienced the story. And Jillian can tell you about that. But these things are just astound when realizes how important Anne Frank's story has been after the fact. So, we're doing great.
A Sunday schmooze with a good Long Island bagel? How could you pass that up?
Yes, a lot of people come for the bagels, too.
Just for the bagels and a little schmear, and you're all set.
Vegetarian.
Jillian,
yeah, I hope.
Jillian, you do
have... I want some lox.
Some lox sets. Yeah. Well, now you're talking my kind of food. Jillian, you have so many famous people that you feature in your book and how they can relate or how they understood. And Frank, tell us about a few of them.
And how they choose to be involved. Believe it or not, when I started the charity, Ron, I started it from my own home. And it was like myself and a part-time administrator. And of course, you know, when I retired a couple of years ago, it had grown as into one of Britain's most highly regarded charity. But this is what you call chutzpah. And I've always been told chutzpah was my middle name. I was very privileged to meet Audrey Hepburn in 1991 when she was in London doing readings from Anne's diary for UNICEF. Michael Tilson Thomas, the famous American composer, had written music to back it. It was an astonishing event. And Otto Frank's stepdaughter, Eva Schloss, who's one of the co-founders of the Anne Frank Trust, and myself were invited backstage to meet Audrey Hepburn. You can imagine how exciting that was. And we walked into her dressing room, and Eva said to Audrey, you know, my stepfather and mother really would have loved you to play. They really wanted you to play Anne Frank in the 1959 movie, the George Stevens movie, The Diary of Anne Frank. And Audrey looked at her and said, you know why I couldn't do it, Eva? And Eva said, well, I assumed you had filming commitments, and I know you felt that you were a little bit old to play the part, but you still looked very young. And Audrey just looked at Eva and said, No, it was too painful for me. And in my book, I describe all about Audrey's background, as one of the many people, as you say, that I describe their stories and how they link to Anne Frank in many surprising ways. And with that, the two women hugged. They were exact contemporaries, born the same year, Eva Schloss and Audrey Hepburn. And, of course, at that point, I stepped in and I said, Audrey, you wouldn't consider becoming a patron of the Anne Frank Trust? And she said, of course. And it was a very opportunistic moment because she was so emotional with Eva. And of course, as a one-man band with a part-time administrator, I had, for my new charity, the Anne Frank Trust UK, Audrey Hepburn on the notepaper as one of our patrons. Mm. And very similar with Steven Spielberg when we were starting out as well. And also I describe, as you mentioned, about Nelson Mandela and how he was so deeply affected by reading Anne's diary before he became a political prisoner and what happened on Robben Island when he was a political prisoner with Anne's diary. It's an astonishing story that was told to us by Nelson Mandela. The book has actually sold out at the moment in the US, but they are having a new stock shipped over, which will be here in February. So if people want to pre-order the book on Amazon, they can do, or through Barnes & Noble, etc. There will be books next month to restock because we've had such a run on the books.
I want to give, if someone is just tuning in, I want to make sure that they know the name of the book. It's the title of the book. It's The Legacy of Anne Frank by Gillian Wanes, spelled W-A-L-N-E-S Perry. And so if you're looking for it online, that's how you find it.
Yes, yes, The Legacy.
I'd like to say that Gillian is too modest. She would probably not tell you, but for Americans, it's impressive to know that she was honored by Her Majesty Elizabeth II, Queen of England, with the MBE, a member of the Order of the British Empire, for her educational work on Anne Frank for all of these decades. So she is a real achiever in the area of human rights and well-recognized in the United Kingdom as well as elsewhere.
Congratulations, Gillian, for that. Gillian,
thank
would you.
You
mind if I ask Judd a few questions, just some quick things about the arts and the community in the area right now?
Not at all. I'm very interested to hear them.
Thank you. Judd, what I was saying before at the very beginning, if you remember back when the internet was starting, do you remember how people were saying, you know what, no one's ever going to go out anymore. We're just going to sit around at home and we're going to watch Netflix and we're going to make our own microwave popcorn. And it was going to be the death of movie theaters. It was going to be the death of art centers. And look what's happening in 2019. It seems to be more vibrant than ever.
Well, you know, we've created, I haven't done it myself, but the director of our cinema, Dylan Skolnick, has been instrumental in creating something called the Art Cinema Convergence, and it's got art cinemas around the country, and there's a lot of them. And they've worked together to encourage this transformation. It was very expensive. We were very worried, just as everyone was, and we had to raise a lot of money to be able to show DCP, you know, digitized film, even though we're also still accredited by the Smithsonian Institute to show 35mm, 16mm, and archival films. So we show 35mm when we can. However, Wes, we were scared. But something that I think people have discovered is that it's not that much fun sitting by yourself alone in your house in front of your computer or your special TV watching a film. Going to the movies has always been a ritual. It has been a thing that people do together. You sit spellbound in darkness together and you share the experience on a giant screen. And some films are only meant to be seen on a giant screen. In fact, most of them are. And so I think people understand that coming to the movies is an experience that is part of our culture. It's ingrained within us, and it gives us something that we can't get otherwise. So modern technology, once we've managed to pay for it, has enhanced the experience of coming to the cinema. I would say that it's much more fun and it's fulfilling coming to a place like the Cinema Arts Center and other art cinemas, because at a multiplex, you're just an anonymous person in a vast you know, place almost like an airport with lots of rooms, and then all they want to do is sell you candy, whereas you come to a place like the Cinema Arts Center and you have someone like Gillian Wells Perry coming, who is not, we're not only going to see this wonderful film on 35 millimeter, by the way, but we're also going to have a human being who's very important, connected with the film and the subject matter, who's going to talk with us. You can't get that in your living room. So it's a totally different experience. And yes, we're growing. We are not shrinking. We are growing.
I'm just curious. Do you have a film festival? I don't know. Do you have one later in the summer or?
Well, no. Interestingly, there are a lot of places that have like a 1 or 2 week film festival and then they close down. We are a 365-day-a-week film festival. We have, 12 screenings of three different films every day. And we also have special series on particular subjects that would constitute a film festival. For example, we have the LGBT Film Festival, which we first housed when it started quite a number of years ago. So that will go on for a few days and be a special festival. We'll have a women's film festival. We'll have a Black History Month festival. We'll bring in a special thing of, French or Italian films, or we'll celebrate somebody. Or the silent series. So we are a combination of a film festival that and a movie. I don't know how to phrase it. I don't want to say we're a movie theater. Let's just say we are a film festival 365 days of the year with great variety, okay?
And just like they say in the song Cabaret, no fun sitting alone in your room, right? Just get out there and do something.
That's right, and Joel Grey was one of my special guests. And that's kind of interesting because, don't forget, the movie Cabaret, for which he won an Oscar, beating out the two men who were actors who were nominated for The Godfather, he was, of course, the epitome of Weimar, decadence and creativity as the Nazis were coming to power. So we have guests who can speak to all sorts of issues, and so that just came to my mind because Gillian's program is so relevant to that.
Gillian, I'm going to jump in here because we have 1 minute left. Gillian, what is next for you? You've obviously written The Legacy of Anne Frank. As you said, people can order it on Amazon right now. Do you have any other works in the works?
Yes, there may be soon, but watch the space, but lecturing. And also really sort of advising the Anne Frank Center. They have got amazing programs for schools and for young people and for teachers as well. So if anyone in the listeners wants to bring an Anne Frank program, an educational program, into their school, they can contact the Anne Frank Center at annefrank.com. And also just to say, Ron, anyone coming on Sunday, bring a large packet of tissues because the movie is so powerful and so emotional. And sadly, many of those people in the film have now passed on. It's really going to be something very special for them to see.
Gillian Wands
Perry. That's another reason.
I'm sorry, Judd. Yeah, I'm just about out of time. I was going to say Gillian Wands Perry is the author of The Legacy of Anne Frank. Judd Newborn is the curator of the Cinema Arts Center on Long Island in Huntington. And the discussion and the documentary on Anne Frank will be shown this Sunday at the center. Gillian, Judd, I thoroughly enjoyed talking with you today, and I hope that we get to speak again in the future. Thank you very much for your time.
Will do, Ron. Lovely to speak to you.
You're very welcome.
Yes, all you loyal WSHU classical music-loving fans, we haven't lost our minds and we haven't changed our format, don't worry. But it's the Ramones. And it's the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We spoke about Anne Frank, and I know it's kind of a reach, but at the same time, it does have to do with the Cinema Arts Center and what they're doing. And coming up on Sunday the 13th, there will be a talk about the Ramones, one of the greatest rock and roll punk bands ever. Some people think they were the best. The book is Why the Ramones Matter, and it's written by Donna Gaines. And Donna, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Oh, thank you, Ron. Nice to be here.
They simply are. And let me back up for just one moment. I got more comments about doing this show today than any of the others that we've done in the last few weeks. People I know were calling me up, people here at the radio station saying, I can't wait to listen to this conversation about the Ramones. Why is it that today in 2019, they still can elicit such a reaction?
Oh, well, first let me say to all the Ramones listeners, gabba gabba hey, that's our greeting. They are remarkable because their legacy is extending into the 21st century. Even though they retired in 1996, they today have fans that span three generations, maybe four, if you count the little kids at the skate park that like to skate to some of their songs. But they, you know, they're really legendary, and the fans are extremely loyal.
Let's pack up. Just a tiny bit for those who may not know the story of the Ramones. First of all, where are they from?
Forest Hills, Queens, in the state of New York.
Not a lot of rock and roll bands came out of Forest Hill, Queens. Am I right?
No, I think there were others. They're just not ones that we would necessarily be that interested in. But they really, I think they were, when you think about the boroughs of New York, the New York Dolls came from Staten Island. So the tri-state area is really rich. And this is really New York music at least where it germinated, where it began.
David Johansen and the guys came out of Staten Island, and you had the Ramones coming out of Queens, and they all ended up on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, at CBGB's.
And which was one of, for those who don't know, but most people do know CBGB, it was one of the iconic rock and roll heavens, if you will, where a lot of young bands would go to play and to be discovered. It was right on the Bowery.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a television and Blondie and Patti Smith. Just so many bands debuted there, broke there, cultivated their style there. The New York Dolls, of course, preceded all of this, and they were more involved at Max's Kansas City and the Mercer Theater. The Ramones, you know, just took the subway from Forest Hills. They were four guys that grew up together in a similar neighborhood, hung out together. Dee Dee Ramone, who was the legendary songwriter and bass player, said they were the obvious creeps of the neighborhood. So they were street kids, and they dreamed of going to New York City and hanging out, and they did that. They went to see all the bands. They were inspired by the New York Dolls, and they put out their first album in 1976, but it was considered the shot heard around the world. It was a American Revolution that sort of transformed music as we know it in a lot of arenas.
Now, not to give too much away about myself, but that's where I grew up. And yes, indeed. And that's why I still get a kick when I go back today and I visit family who were there and I look at Second and Bowery and I see the sign for Joey Ramone Place and I start to laugh because I'm thinking, wow, if he could only actually envision what happened in 2019 and that his name is up on a street sign.
Yeah, I mean, that's the glory and the tragedy of the whole situation, that they were anointed. You know, by 1996, when they retired, a second generation, Generation X, the bands like Green Day and Soundgarden and Rancid, openly acknowledged them as their forerunners, as a huge inspiration. They were considered gods by these these younger bands, and they started to get their proper respect. Also, Argentina, Brazil, worldwide, they got a lot more radio airplane, a lot more mainstream press than they ever did here. They were selling out stadiums at 30,000 night after night, but not in their own country. So for them in 2019, I don't think they could have imagined that they would have finally received their just respect from us.
I walk around Times Square during the holidays, and I see when the jackets are open, and it wasn't that cold, and I see the jackets and the coats open, and the kids are wearing Ramones T-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, man, they are more popular today. And as you said, from tourists from overseas than I think that they ever could have thought was possible.
Yeah.
Did they want to be popular?
Oh, yeah. They definitely were true believers in the American dream. They wanted to be rock stars. They thought that they were America's Beatles. That they could be, they wanted to be America's Beatles. They wanted to play everywhere. They wanted to have a way to make a living where they wouldn't have to have bad jobs. Johnny was famous for saying work is bad. Yet they had an incredible work ethic. They were the most hard touring bands. I think they did over 22 years, maybe over 2,000 shows, and they were always on the road. And they pushed it very hard. They were like a fighting army. And they influenced so many people. So that there are toddlers today that are getting Ramones onesies. Babies, you know, little babies wearing these T-shirts. There are fashionistas wearing them. There are hardcore fans. And all you have to do to make a friend is wear one. And if you're true fans, you'll make a friend right away. I was in Mexico in the 1980s. And somebody saw me wearing my T-shirt, and they said, Los Ramones. And instantly we had a rapport. I was like 13 people sitting around talking about the Ramones. And pretty incredible.
Just a little inside baseball stuff here. Where did they get their name from?
I think it was a name that Paul McCartney used to hide out.
As a pseudonym, right?
Yes, yeah, so they liked that. But then Tommy said, maybe we just liked the way it sounded, that it just sounded cool. And there are people who think that the Ramones were brothers. If they don't really know the band, they might think they were, but of course they weren't. Yet, interestingly, they created an almost sibling or family community for themselves and the fans so that people borrowed. Like, for example, there's a band, the Young Rochelles, that I've been doing some appearances with. They'll be appearing with me. They're fantastic at the event in Huntington and on January 13th. And so they call themselves Ricky Rocky and Rookie Rochelle. and so Tommy, Johnny, Joey, and Dee Dee became the Ramones. Those weren't their real names. Once upon a time, I was known as Tessa Rae Corpse Grinder after a band that I was involved with. So that was just the culture back then. And today, people around the world of all ages consider themselves siblings, like Ramones siblings, because it's really a family. Only the Grateful Dead created this kind of tribe in my memory. I'm sure there are others, but just from my experience.
So if you had to rank some of the best rock punk bands at the time, where would you put the Ramones? Are the Ramones, you were saying before, the Clash, the Sex Pistols, Television, New York Dolls possibly in there?
Well, my personal opinion or just from what I've heard on the street, the Ramones to me will always be the best and the first because I'm from Rockaway Beach, Queens. The surf town that is made famous by the Ramones. And they are the ones that are credited with really spearheading the genre. They were the very first to put out, their album was considered the groundbreaking album. Everything that followed followed after them, including the Sex Pistols, who were an invention and, you know, more of a marketing device, although fantastic, and the Clash, who were inspired by them and certainly took it in another direction, a more political direction, and added in, reintroduced guitar, more guitar leads to the music. But I think it's just a matter of history, cultural history, that first came the Ramones. But you love the band that you love. Certainly I love every band that I just mentioned, but I have a special connection to the Ramones.
You described the Ramones, obviously, were not brothers, but they were still a family in many respects. And in a paragraph of your book, I believe you described them as a dysfunctional family.
Maybe one of the worst. Yeah, they were known for the little toxic stuff that went on. They were cooped up in a van, you know, a small van, touring for so many years, and they had very intense personalities, and there were, you know, some people had some of the members had challenges with addiction, mental illness. There was bullying, so there was a lot of drama that went on, rivalries, and you know, they each had their own role. I mean, I think when you think about it, Joey was the heart of the band, Dee Dee was the soul, Tommy was the visionary, and Johnny was the one that had the cojones. I don't know what the FCC thinks about some of these words. I hope not going to lose a license from this, but he was very tough, and he was basically, after Tommy left as the manager, Johnny was charged with herding a group of cats, along with, of course, their tour manager, Monty Melnick, who's loyal and faithful, and in his own right, a talented musician and author. But they, you know, they weren't the easiest people in the world, and they were young, and you know, they had a lot on their plate.
We only have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to try and sneak in two or three questions here. I know they toured a lot, and mm-hmm. they were very popular overseas. But for me, they were always the quintessential New York band. And I love Tommy's line when he said, "New York was the perfect place to grow up neurotic." That says it all.
Yeah. Well, it's such an intense place. And when you think about the cultural histories of the people who migrated here, you know, off of Ellis Island, you know, the Ramones were part of the third generation nation of immigrant children of immigrants, first and second generation. And, you know, there just was every kind of a melting pot, every kind of food you could want to eat, and all sorts of cultural interests and cultural influences and interests. And the Ramones plucked those like a garden and put them into their songs, everything from chicken vindaloo to carbona and glue.
For the fans who are listening right now, how many Ramones were there in total?
Oh, well, the four principals, and then Marky was the drummer that replaced Tommy. CJ was the bass player that replaced Dee Dee. And then Richie Ramone, who was with them for a while, and then Elvis Ramone, who's actually Clem Burke from Blondie. So, and I would add Billy Rogers, who played with the Heartbreakers, because he did he played on the recording of Time, the Chambers Brothers.
So there were nine of them?
Yeah, just depending on, you know, yeah, eight usually are acknowledged. I always add in Billy Rogers.
Why did they decide to quit?
Oh, well, Joey was really sick. Joey had, as you may know, it's what killed him was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Mm-hmm.
And he just couldn't do it anymore. And I think Johnny also, Johnny wanted to go out on top. He said, "I don't want to keep playing until we suck. I want to keep," you know, 1996, they had been reborn through this second generation connection with these younger bands. And they just said, "Let's, it's enough now." And I think then Joey wanted to do solo projects. He came out with a solo album that was really acclaimed after that. And, you know, to this day, Marky, Richie, and CJ continue to produce music, and they're still touring. So they're still bringing the good news, according to the Ramones, far and wide.
And I know that you said in your book that they basically, the Ramones, saved rock and roll, which was kind of going astray at that time, right?
Well, it was going astray into the tomb. I mean, it was dead. It was really boring to some. You know, rock and roll is for the youth. It's for the street. It's raucous. It's rowdy. It's dirty, rowdy and dirty. And, you know, at the time that the Ramones broke, you know, the whole 60s thing had run out of gas. And everything was corporatized, and people were in it for money, and everybody had to be a maestro. And there was really no place for the average normal kid. You had to be, like, beautiful, perfect, rich. It just wasn't rock and roll. And disco had subversive roots and was interesting, but it is a different type of sound and different dress code, and some of the clubs were inaccessible. And we just, you know, I remember being in that moment in history and just saying, oh, man, I'm just feeding off of, like, the dying carcasses of Southern rock here. And, you know, where is there something cool and new to do? And the Ramones came out of glitter and glam, you know, influenced, of course, by Warhol and the Dolls, and they just broke the sound barrier. They just changed everything for a lot of people, for millions of people who could just start their own bands. Bands like the Young Rochelles will be playing, you know, at our show at Huntington at the Arts Cinema, the Center, Cinema Arts Center. So it just fantastic stuff came out of that eruption.
Donna Gaines, she will be at the Cinema Arts Center on January 13th talking about why we're all Zippy the Pinheads and talking about why the Ramones matter. And you can buy it online. It's a fantastic book if you're a Ramones fan, if you love that time, and if you love the Mud Club and CBGB and Max's Kansas City. It's a great book. Please pick it up. Donna Gaines. Donna, thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Ron.
That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Associate producers Christian Carter Sabrina, Natalie Chafari, Carrie Frank, digital editor, Ann Lopez, the producer, Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.